and welcome to the Triathlon Coach Podcast. My name's Simon Ward and I'm your host for this weekly show where my goal is to share practical, usable advice from the best athletes, coaches and experts from the world of triathlon so that you can get the most from your training time and maximize your enjoyment of the triathlon lifestyle. If you don't already know me, I'm the founder of thetriathloncoach.com and the SWAT Inner Circle, and I've been a triathlon coach for over 20 years, working with absolute beginners right up to Olympic athletes and coaching them to race at distances from sprint through to Ironman. Reviews and ratings are the currency of podcasts, so if you enjoy today's conversation, I'd really appreciate it if you could drop into iTunes, Podbean or Stitcher and leave a rating and a review. And while you're there, please subscribe to our weekly episodes so that they can be downloaded straight into your phone or your iPad or wherever you choose to listen to them. And finally, to say thank you, I have a free gift for you. I've put together 25 of my top tips amassed from 30 years of racing and training and coaching in the sport. All you have to do is email triathlonsuccess to beth@thetriathloncoach.com and she'll send it right out to you. Okay, now it's time to crack on with today's guest. Well, listeners, welcome back. I'm your host, Simon Ward, and today I'm joined by a man who, if you've finished many of the Ironman events, 70.3 or full distance in Europe or Africa, you may well have had him calling you across the line. His name is Mr. Paul Kay. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Cheers, Simon. Thank you very much. Happy New Year to everybody. This is the first bit of work I'm doing for 2019. Not that it's work, but it's work-related, so... Yeah, you've kicked me out of my holiday and back into reality.
Yeah, but Paul, I know what your schedule was like last year. I mean, we've been trying for a few months to get this call together. every time that I messaged you, every time I saw you, you were heading off here, you were commentating on one race, then you were off to another one, then another one, and then even after Hawaii, you didn't get a break because you were on your way somewhere else, and it didn't really stop for you until just before Christmas, did it?
Well, I left home on the 21st of April last year, and other than shooting back for the 70.3 World Championship, which as a South African we very proudly hosted in Nelson Mandela Bay, Port Elizabeth, in September, I only got home briefly after, you know, the Ironman World Championships in Kailua Kona. I got home at the end of October. I was home for a wee bit and then had to shoot off. As a matter of fact, I landed in Cape Town and left international arrivals and walked straight across to domestic departures to go to Johannesburg for a big 5150 we've got up there before I could actually come home. And since the World Championships in Kailua Kona, I have been to Bahrain and Argentina. So, yeah, my year officially ended on the 9th of December.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you deserve a few weeks off, Paul, to be quite honest.
You know what I worked out, Simon? I worked out just the flying, so let alone trains, buses, rental cars, driving to and from events, just on aeroplanes, if 24 hours is a day and there are 7 days in a week. I spent 3 weeks on an aeroplane last year.
Wow. You must rack up a fair few air miles. Do you get all the points and the bonuses and that? Well, oh, Mr. K, welcome back. We've upgraded you to business class today, or is that what you get anyway?
No, the airlines, any excuse not to upgrade you. I find the only airline where I've had any success in that regard is Emirates, and I typically fly Emirates in and out of South Africa, and their Sky Rewards program make it fairly easy to use your miles. As an example, coming back from Buenos Aires, and just to put it in perspective, if you could fly Cape Town, Buenos Aires direct across the Atlantic, it's probably about a 9-hour flight. But it took me 2 days because I flew Cape Town, Dubai, Dubai, Rio de Janeiro, Rio de Janeiro, Buenos Aires. And Dubai to Rio de Janeiro is 15 hours. And then the plane sits on the ground for 2 hours in Rio de Janeiro. You're not allowed to get off. And then you fly a further 3 hours to Buenos Aires. Now, that was fine. I'd been in Abu Dhabi. I'd been at the Formula One Grand Prix just as a treat to myself and my best mate for his 50th birthday. And it was fine, economy class all the way there, just a little bit uncomfortable when I finally got to Buenos Aires. But in BA, the Friday before the Ironman South American Championship, I'd been for a fairly long run. and I've got hamstring problems in my right leg after destroying my knee on the finish line of Ironman Austria 2016. And my hamstring just got a little bit tight and it pulled my back out and I could barely move. So I was on very strong painkillers and anti-inflammatories and muscle relaxants. And so the first thing I did was I went onto the Emirates webpage and saw that I had enough miles. And fortunately, I'd bought an economy class ticket that was upgradable. And boom, my upgrade was accepted. But I haven't had the fortune of getting to the gate and they take your boarding pass away and they issue you a new one. No, that has not happened to me yet.
Ah, you need to be in the Mike Riley category, I think, for that to happen, don't you?
Probably. Well, you see that Mike Riley, when you're traveling across the States and he's on the West Coast, it's very easy to rack up miles very quickly in the US because, for example, San Diego across to New York is a 6 and a bit hour flight. Mm. But when I fly, let's say, Frankfurt, where I often base myself, to Palma, Mallorca, that is a not even 90 minutes. Do you know what I mean? So you're not doing big miles. And the majority of my flying or the majority of my traveling in continental Europe, I try and drive because then there's space for a bicycle and space for dirty washing and stuff like that. So I don't do as much flying as people think. And because I pay my own travel, I try and fly best value. And not always can I stick to one alliance and rack up the miles and get that status.
Oh, well, let's go back a bit, Paul. I mean, you're a busy man now, but how did you I have an inkling from your website that you didn't start out as a commentator. You were in radio originally, weren't you? Were you like the morning DJ that everybody drove to work listening to, or did you have a different slot? Were you like the late night man?
I'm like Bill Gates, a university dropout, just not as wealthy. I dropped out of university and joined Cape Town's biggest commercial radio station at the age of 20. And at the time, I was the youngest DJ on FM stereo in the country. A radio station at the time called Radio Good Hope Stereo, and we were bilingual. So it was Radio Good Hope Stereo, which is the Afrikaans version. I started out working weekends. Very quickly did my weekend shows and started doing weekday sport on the morning drive and lunchtime and afternoon drives. And then doing the sports, I got invited once in a while to come to sports events. And then eventually I got asked to do a bit of commentating. And my first proper commentating job was December 1991. It was in South Africa. We're very big on inflatable powerboat racing. And I commentated the South African Championships inflatable powerboat racing. And that's how I got a taste for announcing. And I actually did that. You know, you talk about paying your dues in the 10,000 hours, et cetera. I commentated and announced powerboat racing in South Africa free of charge for the first 7 adult working years of my life.
Wow. So you have paid your dues then.
Well, you know, and then that's how I got into it. And then how I got into triathlon. I was always interested in triathlon somehow. I don't know why, but something about it had caught my fancy at university already, even though I never did it. I did a bit of swimming at school. I played water polo. I cycled quite a bit at varsity, dabbled in running, but that was the part I hated the most. And so, you know, I kind of knew of triathlon. And then I worked at the Cape Town Marathon as the like on the ground TV presenter. It was one of my first big TV jobs as a youngster. I was 24 years old. It was 1994. And the producer of that program said, hey, kind of like your style, we've got this triathlon series that we need to voice. Do you want to be the voice for it? So I can try. And it was in the deep end, let me tell you, because there would be no script. You would talk to pictures for the 30-minute program. And that was back in 94. And that was, at the time, South Africa's, well, probably one of the world's bigger international sprint triathlon series. It started in Mauritius, it went to Namibia, it went to Zimbabwe, and then all across South Africa. I think there were like 10 to 11 races. And I would always do that for TV. And then just to jump to potentially what might be your next question, how did I really get into triathlon? I eventually got invited by the sponsors to go to the opening race in Mauritius. And that was the year 2000. I'd recently become a dad because my son had been born. And I'm sitting around there. I'd left radio DJ to be the station manager of the radio station, just turned 30 in the corporate world. The waistline was growing a lot faster than my bank balance. And a couple of the pro athletes, including the likes of Reinhard Tissink and people like that, said to me, "Oi, you sound like you know what you're talking about, but have you ever done a triathlon?" And I hadn't. So I agreed to do it. I had a Speedo, which was my race suit, and then the event's oversized cotton t-shirt was my top. I borrowed a mountain bike from the hotel, which was basically a farm gate with wheels, with the back wheel touching the inside of the frame and the pedals bent on the cranks, and it weighed a little bit less than a Titanic. And off I went. It was a 600-meter swim. I was last out of the water. A 20K bike, I was last off the bike. 5K run, I ran 31 minutes, and I was second last across the finish line. And that was August 2000. And the bug bit even harder than ever before, and I've been addicted to swim bike run ever since.
Well, your story sounds a bit like a Bob Babbitt story of getting started in triathlon, meeting some guy who hangs out in a bar and getting a cruiser to ride and a pair of basketball sneakers.
Well, at least I didn't take like a flask of drink with me and a lunchbox of food, you know. And you know what happened then? I got home and I'm like, wow, this is cool. And you know what also happens to some people? You know, your child is born and you think to yourself, oof, I want to be fit for my kids so that when they're 15 and I'm 45, I can run around and kick a ball or go for a bike ride or go for a run. And so that was kind of like, it was a catalyst towards me going, if I want to be fit at 40, I need to be fit now at 30. And the bug bit just at the right time, got home, put slicks on my mountain bike, started doing a lot of local triathlons. December 2001, bought my first ever road bike, did my first ever bike race in 2001 as well. The Cape Town Cycle Tour, which in those days used to be called the Cape Argus Pick and Pay Cycle Tour, did my first half marathon then. And it just kind of went from there. And I did my first 70.3 in 2004 in Nelson Mandela Bay, Port Elizabeth, which was the test event before Ironman was launched. And did that on a little bit of training. I remember sitting on Hobie Beach, where we still start the race to this day, wishing that the sand would open up and swallow me and take me away, because I was so, so scared.
So that's,
but I did that, and I loved it.
So what you said there was interesting. So there's a footballer in the UK called Peter Crouch. He's probably the tallest footballer you like to see. He's sort of 6'8", I think. He's just started doing a podcast with a couple of radio presenters. He's actually quite humorous for a footballer. But he was talking, about when he played for Liverpool. He got picked for England, and they were travelling to Wembley on the bus, and all the fans were there. And he said, "I saw this bloke sat in a pub, and he was just nursing a pint and reading the paper, and the football was on in the background of the TV." And he said, "At that moment in time, I was so nervous. I wished I could swap places with him. I was just about to make my debut for England, but at that moment, I wanted to swap places with that old bloke in the pub so he could come and sit here and I could sit and have his pint." And then the two presenters are saying, "Yeah, but, you know, all Olympic athletes are like that. All athletes have that moment just before the start where if you offered them the opportunity to have a time warp to somewhere else in the world, they'd wish that they were there. But, of course, yeah. as soon as you hit the water, all of those fears go, don't they, and you're into the race."
Well, I was convinced in the water, immediately settled down. The water calmed me. I was feeling good. But I was convinced, and I still swear by it to this day, that there were underwater speakers and somebody was playing the theme to Jaws. Convinced of it. And nobody can change my mind.
No, but I bet there'd be a lot of people listening to that, Paul, that will have probably been at races and experienced that very same feeling. So maybe you're right. Maybe there is something.
But, you know, you talk about a time warp. You know, once the cannon went, it was like a time warp. Simon, you know what it's like. Yeah. A lot of people, the thing they fear the most about doing an Ironman 70.3 or doing a full Ironman is how long it takes, you know, how long the day could be. But once the cannon goes, the day flashes by so quickly. It's unbelievable. And I remember running down the finish line. And if I look at the finish line arch now compared to what it was then, it was just this little blow-up arch. It was such a fantastic feeling, and that sense of accomplishment was massive. And I never forget that moment, and I don't forget any of my triathlon moments. And that's what helps me feel the fears, the anxiety, the nerves, the joy, the sense of accomplishment of all the athletes who do these events when I'm on the finish line and on the microphone.
Well, you talk about it being a long day, Paul, but it's got to be just as long when you're a commentator, hasn't it? Because you're down there. I've seen you at races. You're down there before the swim starts, while all the athletes are in. transition, getting ready. As soon as it's okay for them, to start broadcasting, you're on the mic, and you don't disappear straight after the last finish has got across the line, do you? Because there's always somebody who wants to have a chat. You know, you're full of adrenaline. So the day is just as long for the commentators. How do you keep your energy up all day? Do you take breaks? I mean, I talked to Riley about this, and he said, no, the energy of the athletes and the thing keeps me going. Yeah. The only time I disappear is when I go for a pee. Yeah.
So Mike Riley's a machine. How he does it, I don't know. You know, he's often a one-man machine at all his races. He's just one of those freaks of nature. You know, you get the Michael Schumachers, the Michael Jordans, you get the Tiger Woods, and then you get Mike Riley. I don't necessarily have his stamina. I always work with a fairly big team of people. We're never less than three people at a full Ironman, sometimes more depending on the nature of the event and the logistics of the event and how much of the event the race director wants us to cover. I have my theories on how much of the event we should cover. I believe the energy should be saved for the finish line, so don't spread out what we do too far, but that's another story altogether. And typically, I do take breaks. You know, you've got to work with – I believe we're a team. Everybody has their job to do. Everybody needs their time to shine, if you'd like to call it that. And everybody needs their time on the carpet and on the mic. So I take regular, well-planned breaks. My voice is such that it's a fairly deep resonant voice. And because it's deep and resonant, there's a lot of vibration in my voice box. And that vibration wears the voice box down very quickly. So typically you'll see at a race, we're up. I mean, if it's a 6:30 start, which a lot of races are, we're on site 4:30, 4:45. So you're waking up at 3:30, 3:45. So it's a long day already. And then, you know, with the rolling starts, often we don't finish at midnight. A lot of races we finish after midnight. And then you got to, you know, then the team congratulate each other. And sometimes people finish after the cutoff. So typically, you know, you're up at, let's say, three, let's round it off. You're up at 4 and you get to bed at 2. It's a 22-hour day, to be blunt, and it's 20 hours of working. Yeah. The most brutal day for me is Ironman South Africa, the African Championship, because I don't only do the live announcing, I double up as a TV commentator as well. So the only break I can get is walking to and from the commentator's booth.
So this you in that one there, then when mostly when the guys in are out on the bike, are you doing stuff there while they're commentating on the bike?
Yeah, it's brutal. So that's a big one. But what keeps us going, I try and be announcing fit. So often when I visit people tell me sit. You know, if we have had a function of that, I never sit, I stand, because you stand all day at an Ironman.
Yeah.
I try and keep my voice strong, my voice fit. I try and stay physically fit, which I've struggled with the last couple of years since I hurt my knee. But I'm coming back. I'm getting strong again, because being fit really helps. Little things like when I sort of build up towards heading to Kona, I will do if I have time to run and train, I'll do that all at lunchtime, no matter where I am, so that it's hot, hot, hot. So by the time I get to Hawaii, you know, the heat's not really a factor. And then what Mike says as well, you know, it's the energy of the athletes that you feed off. The energy and the emotion of the athletes and the spectators is what keeps you going. And then another thing that helps is a really good DJ who's playing the right music at the right time. So these are the little things. So, you know, when you can't rush off and grab something to eat or grab something to drink, it's that magic moment between an athlete or something spectacular a spectator does, or, you know, the DJ just hits the right song. And it's all these little things that just keep you going all day long.
I completely understand what you're saying there about the teamwork. I do some commentary on a race series in the UK. We have an iron distance event there, and we're up at, you know, 4 o'clock. We're down by the swim start for 4:45 when the athletes start going into transition, getting the stuff. We've got a 6 o'clock start. I think we finish at 11. But we very rarely get to bed until 1 o'clock. But the first year we did it, there was just two of us. And by the time the last athletes were coming over, it was all we could do to muster a squeak. We'd got far too excited early on in the day. So the next year we learned to be a bit more sparing with our voices. And we got another member of the team in, and that helped. And now there's four of us, and we rotate round. We've got a couple of different venues on the site to go to. But you're right, you know, you have to take those moments. This absolutely that thing about getting fit for the race, fit for commentating.
The other thing that is very important, and I see a lot of newbies or non-professional announcers get wrong is they think they can go 100% all the time. And you can't. You've got to pick your moments. Firstly, choose the critical moments, which when the races I work at, we sit down with the race director and the team and we agree these are the critical moments. Choose the critical moments and really capitalize on them. But also as an announcer, know what you're good at and do what you do well, very well. So for example, I'm not the kind of guy like Jay Style in Nice who can dance up and down the finish line and do that kind of stuff. That's not me. I can't do that, you know. But sometimes you think, oh, I should also do that. But then you don't do it well and then it messes with your confidence because the crowd's not responding. And if your confidence goes, your energy goes. Mm. But this is very much a confidence game. So, you know, just choose your moments carefully. Do what you do well, very well. And the rest gets you through because you've also got to give the spectators a break. They can't be at 100% all the time. You know, you've got to reel them in and then let them go and then pick them up and then drop them down gently. You know what I mean? So it's knowing that and feeling that and being very sort of aware of the periphery. So pick up on cues around you on, hey, this is a good moment. Maybe there's a proposal or something's happening or somebody's crawling that nobody's noticed yet, you know, and draw the crowd's attention to that. So you're on your toes all the time, and it's nowhere near physically as tiring as it is mentally tiring.
Well, you are. So what you're saying there is it's like a performance in itself, what you're doing. You're like the conductor in the orchestra. You're raising the tempo, you're lowering the tempo, you're looking for that right moment. You know, you're giving people energy, but you're taking energy back from them, aren't you?
I like to refer to myself as a medium or as the glue. Basically, I prefer to be invisible. And when I'm doing my job very well, I think I am invisible because what I do is it's all about the athlete and that athlete's moment. And it's bringing everything together to show that there are 3,000 of those moments on the finish line as best possible. Keeping the spectator engaged, making sure the DJ knows what's going top of their game, making sure that we as announcers, we have stories we can tell when it's quiet. We have stories we can tell about athletes when they come down the line to get the spectators really involved. And a lot of people say to me, oh, Paul, you love being in the spotlight. And if you think about it, I'm not in the spotlight at all. I put the spotlight on the athlete. The only time I have to make myself the center of attention is in those sort of 40 minutes of building up the finish line before the first arrival and when things go quiet to kind of keep the spectator there for when the next athlete arrives.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. I've been to races where the commentator thinks it's all about him and, you know, he forgets to call the athletes across the line because he's in the middle of a story or something.
Kinds of commentators. You get commentators who want the pro athletes to love them. So then they focus on the pro athletes and they try and sound like Google. And every time a pro athlete comes down the line and says as much as they can about the pro athlete, the spectator's yawning, hasn't got a clue what's going on, you know, but now they're great mates with the pros. You get other announcers and commentators who focus purely on the spectators. And I've seen many athletes come down the finish line completely forgotten by the announcer. And then you get other announcers, especially when you've got two announcers working together, who sometimes what I call the you know, a joke between two people. What's the word for it when not a personal joke? Any case, it's kind of like they're having a conversation with each other and they're forgetting that the spectators are there and they're forgetting that the athlete's there. Inside joke. So it's this whole inside joke. Mm. They're entertaining themselves without entertaining the spectators who help you make the athlete feel like heroes.
So talking about making the athletes heroes then, I work with a guy in the UK. I don't know if you've come across John Levison. He's done quite a bit.
Oh, I know John well.
Yeah, John, we call him Stato. Stato was a TV character who knew everything about football, actually, but he became just those guys who know all the statistics. You can't fail to have noticed that John has an encyclopedic memory for triathlon. Yep. Are you like that, Paul? I mean, I've listened to you commentate, and you've got a pretty good memory, but how much of that is prep notes and how much of that is just stuff that you pick up and retain?
So a lot of people think that I only work on race day. You never stop working. As an announcer and as a commentator, you're working all the time. you need to be a sponge. You're absorbing everything you see on social media between pro athletes and age group amateurs as well. And at events, I try and talk to a lot of people because it's bizarre what I pick up and remember. And I'm definitely not a John Leveson, but I remember enough to add color to my commentary. And that's critical. I think I try and ensure that I'm extremely well prepped before a race, because that gives me the confidence to go out there and to know that I have something worthwhile to say when there's nothing to be said. But I try very hard not to be Google. I try very hard not to show off how much I know. I don't think that's necessary. But I just want people to know that I care. And so I will pepper my commentary with the occasional tidbit which makes that person know that I know. They just need to know you care. And sometimes it's just eye contact and a smile. You'll notice I never commentate with sunglasses on.
I do, actually. I have noticed that, yeah. Yeah, the first time I came across you, actually, Paul, I think was Ironman Austria in Klagenfurt, one of my favourite races, my favourite venues. I could hear you there commentating. I think I was there watching Friends that year. It might have been 2010. And, yeah,
2010 was my very first international Ironman, and that was Ironman Austria.
Right. And you, at that time, I think, Austria and Nice and South Africa were all part of the Triangle Series. Is that how you got involved in Austria through there?
Yeah, well picked up. So I actually announced – so my Ironman involvement started in the year 2000, the turn of the century, the same time I did my first triathlon. I was the TV voice for the 56-minute documentary made on the first Ironman held in South Africa, just down the road from where I now live in Gordon's Bay. And then in 2001, I was the co-announcer in Gordon's Bay. And then the race fell away, and then there was nothing. And then I did the race in 2004, the 70.3 distance. 2005, I was the TV voice for the race. And 2006, I became one of the announcing team. And that's how I met Helge Lorenz and Stefan Pechnik, because Triangle owned South Africa, they owned Monaco, they owned France. Then what happened was I went through a very unpleasant divorce and a nasty separation, an unpleasant divorce, and my children were taken out of the country, so zero access to my kids, which after the death of my father is probably the most painful thing that has ever happened to me. If anything, it was more painful than the passing of my dad, because it's something that never goes away. And I needed a distraction. And so I started doing endurance sports. I started doing long distance road race, stage races. I started running marathons. I ran San Francisco, London, and New York in an 18-month period. And I also entered my first Ironman. And Ironman South Africa said to me, "No ways, you're not allowed to do Ironman South Africa." And I thought to myself, hold on a second, there's no ways on my salary I could ever afford to race overseas. But then Ironman South Africa were taking a group to Klagenfurt, and that was 2008. So in 2008, I thought, okay, let me put it on the line, and let me put my money where my mouth is, and I'm going to do my first Ironman. And that was because in those days you could cross the finish line with your children. And I'd seen many fathers and mothers crossed the finish line with their children in South Africa. And it always hurt me because my children were very far away. But luckily, I got to cross the finish line with my kids in 2008. I went back in 2009 for redemption because I had a terrible race and I had a worse race, but that's another story altogether. And when I was there, Helge Lorenz said to me, "Paul, don't you please want to be the commentator?" And I said, "Sorry, Helge, I've trained too hard for this. Maybe next year." And then I got back to South Africa. I sent him a thank you note for the entry, and he mailed me back and said, "No, the way you can repay me is be our English announcer in 2010. And that's how it all started. I announced with him in 2010. First international Ironman on the mic went well. We spoke then about maybe. And that was at the same time I'd given up my corporate job and decided to turn my hobby of announcing into a business. So it all... you know, people talk about coincidence. I call it flow. Things just happen to fall together. And I said to him, "Well, do you have other races that maybe I could announce at? You know, by adding English, spoken by a native English-speaking person, you give it that international flavor." And so he said, "Yes. Could I come to 70.3 St. Pölten Ironman Nice, and Ironman Austria. And that was 2011, and off I went. And whilst I was at Ironman Austria, Kevin Stewart, who used to be the managing director of Ironman UK, he saw me, he liked what he saw, and 2011, you'll remember, we launched Ironman Wales in Tenby, Pembrokeshire. And he contacted me and said, hey, would you like to do Wales? So Richard Wallace was working for them. And I said, yeah, but why don't I'm in Europe. Why don't I shoot across to Bolton to meet the team? So in 2011, so in 2010, one international race. In 2011, I did 70.3 St. Bolton, Ironman Nice, Ironman Austria, assisted Whit Raymond at Ironman UK in Bolton, and led the team for the first ever Ironman Wales in Tenby, Pembrokeshire. And anybody who did that, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners did that, will remember what an epic, incredible year 2011 was when the hurricane came across the Atlantic and started tearing our finish line apart. But yeah, and that's how my international announcing started. And at that race in 2011, Helge Lorenz sat me down and said, okay, let's put a contract together. And boom, that was it.
Well, so that was my first experience of you. I wasn't stood at the finish line. I think I was stood just in the park at the back of the finish line where the athletes crisscross and they run around and so they come behind the finish line and then they have to do that bit of a loop around to come onto the lakeside and then turn back into the finish. And I could hear this really enthusiastic South African and I thought, well, I'm going to have to find out who this guy is. I like his style. Anyway, the next year, I can't remember where it was, but I probably saw you again at another race. I think I did Ironman Austria in 2015, I think I did. And that was when we met. I think I probably came and said hello to you then, and I was hoping you were going to meet me at the finish line, and I don't think you were there then. Then 2016, I was doing it again, and that was my race to get my 12th finish for Legacy. And I said, right, Paul, come on. I had every intention
of being there.
I know you did. Well, we're going to get onto that thing that you talked about before. So you said, I'll be there for you today, Simon. So I'm running around and I'm thinking, right, Paul's going to be there. You know, I spoke to him. He's going to call me across the line. And then I got there and it's like, well, where is he? He said he was going to be here. I know I'm a bit slower than I thought. But maybe you can explain what happened in between agreeing to call me across the line and me getting there.
Yeah, I was playing. I was just being silly. You know, sometimes the announcers, we have a bit of fun together, and typically Claudio Schütz, who's the Austrian announcer, we always have a bit of fun and we chase each other up and down the finish line. We rev up the crowds. One of us pretends to be the champion coming down the finish line. Marino von Hunniker was on his way to win it after having won just like 2 weeks before in Brazil, I think. And so we actually ended up, boys being boys, started running down the finish line. I edged in front of him. He edged in front of me, turned into a full-on sprint. You don't sprint when you're near 50. This is just nonsense. And he's 10 years younger than I am. And so I jumped. Now, you know well that the finish line at Ironman Austria is just like in South Africa, same as in Kona. It's a raised platform. So up a ramp, on the platform under the gantry, and down the ramp on the other side. I jumped through the gantry. And it rained a short while previously. The carpet was wet, landed one-footed, right foot down first, not straight, and the knee collapsed. And I ruptured my ACL and tore my meniscus.
Ouch. And that right in front of all of those spectators waiting for the finishes. So that's going to be the most, apart from the power hour at the end, that's going to be the most populated time of the finish line, isn't it? And there you are, flat on your back, writhing
screaming
in agony.
Like a little baby. But you know what? They put me in the med tent. Marino von Hunniker joined me in the med tent because he destroyed himself out on the course, as he does. And off I went to hospital. And they checked me out. And I said, look, do me a favor. Just give me a brace. So they gave me a brace. And I went back to the finish line. I got back at about 5:30 in the afternoon. And I stayed there till midnight.
Oh, well, you must have been – I finished after 5:30 then. So you must have been around. Maybe you were – maybe I
did have a short pain break.
Yeah, that was probably it. Oh, well, you were there. You were there at the finish line when I finished in Kona, so that was pretty good. You and Mike Riley. So I got the two top Ironman commentators in the world at the finish line there. But so is Austria your favourite race then? I mean,
ask me favourite races. That's not fair.
Well, it's like, I suppose that's like asking a father which is his favourite child, isn't it?
or somebody loves music, what's their favorite artist or favorite album? Look, I always take Kona out of the equation, because to me, Kona is in another stratosphere. You know, I always say Kona and Rot, or Roth in English. You take them out of the mix. Hmm. And then if you want to compare races, you can compare.
No, actually, I was referring to Klagenfurt, actually. Is that one of your favorite venues?
Yeah, no. So this is my preamble. So, because people will go, well, why not Kona? Because Kona was a big dream of mine. But South Africa being my home race, and it's a brilliant race, and it's where everything started for me, is without a doubt one of my favorite races. And even though I'm biased and I'm a South African, it is an excellent race. Anybody's come here to do it, go, wow. And I think South Africa showed the world, we really put on a good show for the 70.3 World Championship as well. So I'm very proud to be South African. I'm very proud of our races, but I love Ironman South Africa in Nelson Mandela Bay, Port Elizabeth, which is now the African Championship.
Can I just jump in there, Paul? What I was amazed about with that 70.3 race is how you managed to get those guys to buy into having the best race as well. Because that, in terms of athlete performance, that was just one epic event, wasn't it?
Well, as a quick sidebar, you know, we had our legends there, Paul and Newbie Fraser, Heather Feuer, Dave Scott, Mark Allen. So all the legends were there. And both Dave Scott and Mark Allen were on Marine Drive in front of the Race Village Hotel and across from the finish line as Jan Frodeno, Javier Gomez, and Ali Brownlee come past. And I'm getting goosebumps just telling you this. And Dave Scott and Mark Allen and Andrew Messick started using expletives that they don't normally do. They were so excited. They got goosebumps, and it wasn't a particularly cold day. And Mark Allen came and grabbed me by my shoulder and says, "We are witnessing history. This is the most amazing race I have ever seen." Daniela, Lucy, and Anna Haug the day before, an incredible performance, amazing racing. And the boys on the Sunday, amazing racing. And I might be shocked for this, but I'm of the opinion that 70.3 World Champs is no longer the second cousin to the Ironman World Championship Kailua Kona. It's a standalone, bona fide, shoulder-to-shoulder World Championship. And that race on Saturday and Sunday is what put it there, because the performances by our athletes were simply astounding and amazing.
No, I think I'd agree with you there. I think it's, you know, 70.3 has taken a while to get rolling, and sometimes you need an event like that to make people sit up and think, actually, this is genuine racing. It's not just a sideshow to you know, what's going to happen in October. And those three guys, I mean, they used to do it when they raced ITU, and, you know, having them all fit and in great shape and in the right mindset on that day was just awesome. I spoke to Alistair about it the other day, actually, and we were saying, you know, he said, "I didn't have a particularly good year." And I said, "What about 70.3? He said, "Well, I did my best to win." I went, "I know, but you can't be disappointed when you give it your best."
He was disappointed.
But equally, it's a bit like Lionel Sanders. He's disappointed, but Alistair's a warrior like Lionel, and if he gives it everything and comes second, he's disappointed. But I think he prefers that than he does winning easily.
An easy win. Yeah, I agree with you. So back to the favorite races. I have a huge soft spot for Ironman Austria and Klagenfurt because of the fact that I did it in 2008 and 2009, because it was my first international race I ever announced, but also because I made Austria my home in my first many years of being on the Ironman Europe Tour. I lived with a good mate of mine, Peter Huber, up in Kitzbühel, and Austria was my base. So Austria, as the Germans would say, or in German, meine zweite Heimat. It's my second home, very much so. So I have a huge soft spot for South Africa, for Austria. A race that got under my skin immediately was Ironman Kalmar, Sweden. Wow, I absolutely love that race. I love going there. I love the country, Sweden. I love its nature. I love the gentle yet strong nature of the people as well. And that race and those spectators on that square and all around the course are pretty much untouchable. I think the only thing that comes close is the other big brand in Bavaria. So, or possibly exceeds it, as they claim, with spectators. But it is a super special event. So these are races that I love hugely. But then you love different races for different reasons. So I also absolutely love working with the Spanish team, and we have so much fun in Barcelona. And that race is also hugely popular. More and more spectators getting involved. It's a race that's easy for somebody who wants to do a full Ironman but is nervous. And, you know, that's a great race to come and really taste the Ironman brand and the Ironman experience. And Calais is a great little town. It's extremely cost-effective. The weather's generally spectacular. The people are wonderful. So that's another one of my races I love. And then you just cannot take away Ironman Wales. It is iconic. And I always say you get Ironman, and then you get Ironman Wales. It's a spectacular race. The people of Pembrokeshire were very, you know, at arm's length about it. But the way they've embraced the race, the way they embrace the, you know, 2,500 people and their families who descend on that beautiful little town of Tenby and just, you know, fill up all the guest houses, all the hotels, all the caravan parks in and around Tenby and Pembrokeshire is amazing. And it's added an extra week to their season. But the people take ownership. And the thing, like in Kalmar, Sweden, and in Tenby in Pembrokeshire in Wales, the community embrace Ironman. They take ownership. They want it there. They love having it there. And you, as an Ironman athlete, you feel special when you get there in those communities.
So the first Ironman I ever did was in Penticton in Canada.
Oh, really?
And
yeah.
Legend. It was legendary. There were seven or eight races on the circuit back in the mid-90s that were qualifiers for Kona. And you know, they've obviously expanded rapidly since then. But I asked all my friends that had done them, and Penticton came out top of the vote in you know, by miles. So I went there. I went back seven times, five times to race. I failed to finish once, and then I took a load of athletes with me. Loved it in Penticton. But the whole atmosphere around that town in race week was just awesome. The first time I got there, there'd be signs saying, you know, if you're doing the race, come in and we'll give you a discount on your coffee. But even if you're not doing the race and you're here to cheer a friend, come in and we'll give you a discount on coffee. In fact, actually, we'll give you a discount on coffee because you're here for Ironman. And everybody that you met was either volunteering, had family that were doing it, or had done it before, or was racing. And just the support all the way out on the course. It was an original one lap of everything course. So, you know, spectacular bike route, spectacular run down by the lake. The finish line was awesome. I did a homestay that first week, so I was invited to parties and barbecues and where they wanted me to meet the friends and tell them about this guest of theirs that was doing the Ironman. And I went back, as I said, several more times. Loved it. I was so disappointed when they stopped doing the race there. But that was the whole thing that Ironman used to do in the early days, was to have this huge race going to a small town, and Tenby's like Penticton, the whole town get involved. And when I did Tenby in 2014, I think, I couldn't believe, as I came back into that cobbled area on the run, although I shouldn't have been surprised, because when you go out into the little villages, there's two or three places you go. I went through Narberth, right out on the back of the course, and it looked like the whole village had come out there. There was like a royal parade.
They do.
Several
they
thousand do. People cheering and sitting by the pub, and then you get back to Saunders Foot and you go up Heartbreak Hill there, and again, it's like riding up Alpe d'Huez in the Tour de France. And then when you're out on the run, that first 300 or 400 meters, you just can't see any pavement. It's full of spectators. Then you go out, you know, do that little squiggly sort of out and back everywhere. And then you come back in, and as soon as you hit the cobbles down by the harbour, it's just mobbed with people until you leave the town again. It must be a mile and a half of spectators.
Mentioning one of the epic moments of Ironman, and the only anthem I get emotional about is the South African anthem, but there's another anthem that makes me emotional, and that's when you're down on North Beach and the cliffs are packed with spectators and the beach is full of nervous athletes, and the sun is slowly starting to rise out of the Atlantic, and the RNLI lifeboat station is silhouetted by this rising sun, and then the Welsh national anthem. That moment is there. Not many races can touch that.
Well, you must be being South African, Paul. You must be a big sports fan outside of triathlon. I mean, South Africa have a huge rugby union following, and you know, I love watching the rugby in the UK. And whilst I don't particularly like it when Wales beat England, I can't fail to be to sit there watching on the TV, and I do get goosebumps when you listen to the Welsh crowd sing the Welsh national anthem or Bread of Heaven. It's just phenomenal, particularly when they've got the roof closed at the Millennium, and that's the one stadium I've never been to watch an international, and I must go one day, just partly because I want to experience that sort of that pre-match warm up. Just brilliant.
Well, you know, talking about, you say being a sports fan, and you know, you're English, I'm South African, we have a history, and the only time South Africans and Australians and or New Zealanders unite is when one or the other is playing England and beats England.
Everybody loves to beat England. Must be that old colonial stuff, I think. Everybody's getting a chance to put the boot in when they can.
But I love sports, you're right. I mean, and I'm blessed that I get to do, you know, I get to make a living doing something I love. I love sport. And my particular passion is triathlon, specifically long-distance triathlon, but all triathlon. I mean, from the mixed team relays to sprint distance, you know, tri to Olympic to the Olympics itself. I just love watching triathlon. You know, I've got a pass to pretty much everything online to watch triathlon. And but I love all sport. But the only thing I really make the time to stop and watch is triathlon.
We talked about you having a little embarrassing moment in Austria there. Is that the most embarrassing incident you've had as a commentator? Or have there been others?
Well, sometimes you don't really realize that you might have made a mistake. So I got reminded yesterday, I took a frame into a bicycle shop. I'm busy building a gravel bike because we've got so many beautiful gravel roads here near where I live. And he reminded me that I called his brother-in-law Emily instead of Emil. But apparently it was an honest mistake that's really stuck. And everybody calls this guy Emily now. He's no longer Emil. So you could consider that embarrassing. As a professional, there are sometimes things happen so quickly and the brain can't keep up. Little things like maybe getting the wrong sponsor. So, you know, often on the Europe Tour, you could have Power Bar at XYZ race, Gatorade at the one after that, then High Five, then Lucozade or whatever. You got to remember to get that right every time, you know. So little things like that you could get wrong. Maybe the title of one of the dignitaries, you get that wrong. And me, I'm a Virgo. I'm a perfectionist. I like to believe I'm very professional at what I do. I prepare very hard. So generally, I hate making mistakes, and the smallest mistake I find embarrassing. That trip up on the carpet, that was not embarrassing. That was just stupid. What was I thinking, you know? And I just didn't land it properly, and that was just – yeah. I still look at that and I cringe a little bit. I say, you idiot. You know, it's cost me a lot of aggravation over the last 2 years, but embarrassed per se? No, not really. I don't think so.
Well, okay, let's flip that one then. What are some of your best stories from the finish line?
Oh gosh, you know, I'm probably, you know, Mike Riley is busy writing his book, Finding Your Voice.
And, yeah, it's out. I think he's out now, isn't it?
Well, no, it's at the editors at the moment. Just been speaking to him today, and he did a very good job of chronicling everything that happened at all the Ironmans he's worked. I've been nowhere near as conscientious. I rely on just what I remember. There have been some very memorable moments for all the right reasons and for all the wrong reasons. Me crossing my first finish line with my kids, hugely memorable, very special moment. The first Ironman race I worked at where athletes died. Terrible, terrible moments. Because you know, we're one big family, really. And you know, if you don't know the person, it's extremely sad. It happened in the swim. Very hard to manage, very hard to keep the energy up, you know, very hard to still make it a celebration for the athletes who are racing, who didn't know what was going on, and the spectators didn't know what was going on, yet knowing what had happened. Do you know what I mean? So these are moments that stick with you. But fortunately, one of the big moments that I remember very, very clearly was Team Garwood, Kevin and his son Nicky. They now live with his wife and mother in the UK. South Africans, they were like Team Hoyt. Nicky, cerebral palsy, Kevin would pull him in a kayak, ride a special bike with him, and push him in a special jogger. In the year at 70.3 South Africa, where we lost two athletes in the swim, That was also the year where Kevin and Nicky, after many, many, many attempts, managed to finish the race for the first time. And so we had this at the award ceremony. We paid our condolences to the families and the friends and the fellow athletes of the athletes who passed. And it was a very terrible moment and sad moment. And it kind of takes away the atmosphere for the athletes who had achieved something massive in their own right. But then, thanks to Team Garwood, Kevin and Nicky having made it for the first time, we got to celebrate them, and they changed the tone of the race and the evening altogether. So that was a very, very big moment. Getting them down the finish line of Ironman South Africa as well, hugely memorable moment. And another very personal, very memorable moment is a lady by the name of Chantal Rowell, who passed a couple of years ago. Friend of mine, she'd done a couple of 70.3s. She wanted to do, she'd had ovarian cancer long before. After cancer the first time, she wanted to do an Ironman, and she did 70.3. She failed, she succeeded. She wanted to do Ironman, she failed. And on this particular occasion, I think we still had a mass start at the time, so we had a 5:30 p.m. hard cutoff to get off the bike. And I don't know what it was, something made me go, I'm just going to walk down the finish line to transition and see who makes the cutoff. And with seconds to spare, Chantal came down and crossed the dismount line and made the bike cutoff. And she was in tears, and I shouted out to her, and she came across to me and she said, I can't. And I said, you can, and you will, and I will be there for you. And when she came down the finish line, that was a very, very special moment.
Do you, talking about emotions then, I mean, you know, we've all witnessed as athletes, as spectators, as commentators, some really emotional stuff. You've mentioned a couple of them. Do you ever find yourself having to fight back that, those emotions, like when Chantal came down the finish line? Or you know, has it ever got the better of you, or does your professionalism kick in and you manage to carry it off and do what you're supposed to do?
Look, I'm naturally quite an emotional person, but I do manage it as best possible. I have to shut it off. I'll give you a great example. Ironman Nice 2011. I'm in the transition zone, interviewing some of the athletes. It's time to go down to the beach. Walking, and at Nice, you walk through the finish line to access the start. Walking through the finish line. And I, as I get there, my wife calls me across to tell me my mother had just died. So... now, if you remember earlier, we talk about, like Mike and I both say, we feed off the emotions and the energy of the athletes and the spectators. To do that, you need to be emotionally available, emotionally open. Now, my mom had just passed away. I knew she was dying, but it's still, it's a painful, horrible thing. Yves Cordier and Stefan Pechnik saw me crying on my wife's shoulder, came to find out what was wrong. I told them. They said, go back to the hotel. I said, no ways. My mom always believed the show must go on. And this is not about me. This is about those 2,000 people about to jump in the water. But I had to shut everything down. The hardest Ironman I have ever announced, Ironman Nice 2011, because I had to fake it to make it from 6:30 that morning until it was 10:30, cut off in those days, 10:30 that night. That was memorable.
Oh, yeah, I can tell just talking about it now. I just... think of a moment when we were commentating at the Outlaw race when I was working with my friend Kyle, and he's going to kill me next time he sees me for mentioning this, but there was one of those proposal moments that you mentioned, and so Kyle starts commentating on it and he had to step aside and leave the commentary to me. He just completely lost it. Tears, lump in his throat, couldn't carry on. And he never lives it down to this day. He does get a bit emotional. He has a lot of highs when he's commentating, but on this one, he just let that moment get to him, really. And it stopped him talking, which is also unusual.
Well, it's happened to me many times as well. You know, at the Ironman 70.3 World Championship in South Africa, you know, September last year, I was the host MC at the welcome banquet, and there's this off voice going, please welcome your host tonight, two-time Ironman finisher and South African native, Paul Kay. And I was so overflowing with pride that I became emotional, and I couldn't actually deliver my opening words of welcome, because firstly, I couldn't read what I'd written down with all the tears in my eyes.
Oh, dear.
And I was choked up and I couldn't speak. And I'm getting choked up just telling you this. And some of these stories that I'm retelling, I get choked up. I remember commentating these Ironman Ironman African champs. And I was doing a TV piece and we were actually it was last year. And we were reflecting on 40 years of Ironman. We were showing some incredible stories. And we showed the story of Turiya Pitt, the Australian who got caught in the wildfire and lost pretty much her whole face and nearly couldn't walk again. And we showed her finishing Ironman World Championship. And I actually could not carry on and out commentating. I think it was Greg Welsh with me. You had to continue, you know. So, yeah, there are moments where, as professional as you are still a human being. And I think the spectators like to know that you're human as well. And when they see that human side and you come out a little bit, it doesn't take anything away from who you are as a professional. If anything, they actually respect you more.
Hey, I was going to ask you, you dropped into a bit of Afrikaans at the beginning and you slipped into a bit of German halfway through. I know you've worked in a lot of places. How many languages do you actually speak fluent enough to be able to commentate in them, Paul?
One, English.
Okay.
I say that. I'd like to believe I've got a reasonably decent command of the English language. And I like to not just commentate. I like to paint pictures with my words. I like to, incite a bit of emotion in people, engage with them. And I need to use the full vocabulary that I have available to me to do that, especially in an environment where essentially the same thing's happening 3,000 times over again. Mm. And you need to find different ways of conveying this. I can speak German and I speak Afrikaans, so I get away with a bit of Dutch as well. But no, my German, my Afrikaans is nowhere near good enough, in my opinion, that I would announce in it. However, I do use the German that I know, the Afrikaans that I know, the Dutch that I know. I lived in Japan as a boy. I know a bit of Japanese. I studied a bit of French at school. My first 2 years of high school, I've got a little bit of French, a little bit of Italian. I try and pick up some Spanish, some Swedish. Wherever I go, I try and pick up suitable phrases, suitable words of encouragement, and suitable words of congratulations that I can acknowledge people, greet them and acknowledge them in their language. But what I also try and do is pronounce their names right. And I think the first thing that is critical is pronouncing the person's names right, because you're Simon, but if you were German, you'd be Simon. And I think as a German, you'd rather be Simon, you are an Iron Man, as opposed to Simon, you are an Iron Man. Do you know what I mean? And those things.
Yeah.
I believe make the athlete know that you're paying attention and you care.
Yeah, I've experienced that myself. I think I'm quite good at picking up foreign names and pronouncing them right. But I was amazed that a couple of people came up to me after commentary and said, "Oh, you're the first person that's ever actually pronounced my surname right in a race." So thank you for that. And I'd just done it without even thinking about it. And it wasn't when they were finishing. It was actually as they run past the finish line on the way around to do another lap. And I just gave them a shout out while we were waiting for some finishes. And I got this little thumbs up. And then they came and found me out at the finish line. So that was interesting.
You know who's ridiculously good at that is he works for the ETU and the ITU. We commentated Ironman Wales together 2011, the first time around. You might know his name, Paul Groves. Paul Groves is so multilingual, it's ridiculous. And his pronunciation is impeccable. I mean, I don't come close to him. I remember him at the ITU WTS Grand Final in Rotterdam. And he was helping out at T1 because at the swim start because it was across the river. And we had a bit of a delay, and because there were about like 150 people in the start group, he announced every person's name. And they actually came to me afterwards in the awards and said, whoever that guy was, he's amazing because he pronounced every name 100% correctly. He used to commentate Ironman across the US. He used to be part of the Mike Riley's team in Hawaii. He was always in charge of the hot corner. He's fluent in Japanese. Which studied in Japan, as a matter of fact. He studied Japanese in the U.S., and then he went to study in Japan. So his Japanese is absolutely brilliant. And the Japanese get so excited when they know that you can speak their language. So Witt is an asset in that regard, and that's why he does a lot of the Far East announcing.
Say, we've covered a lot of races today, Paul. There must be some that you haven't been to. Are there any that you'd really like to commentate at?
Oh, yeah, geez, for sure. I mean, I would love to go to Taupo, New Zealand. Hopefully I will be there for the 70.3 World Champs. That's a race. I'd love to just even go and watch it. I would love to do Lanzarote, because Lanzarote is just an iconic race, you know. So I would love to commentate Lanzarote. I've yet to commentate Ironman European Champs in Frankfurt. Maybe one day that'll be added to my schedule. And then, you know, if possible, I'd love to like do a tour of every year a different race internationally. I'm blessed in that, to my knowledge, I'm the only announcer that announces Ironman races that has announced an Ironman-owned event on all six continents and in both hemispheres. Because when I did the 70.3 World Champs in Mooloolaba in Australia, that got me into Australia. I've announced in China, the Middle East, Africa, Europe, in America at the World Champs, and in South America and Argentina. So, you know, that's quite a rare. I think I'm the only one to hold that distinction. And another strange fact that you might not know, I think I'm the only person to announce two Ironman-owned events on the same weekend in two different continents and two different hemispheres, 70.3 Dubai on a Friday and 70.3 South Africa on a Sunday. And then last year I did the full Ironman Kalmar. And on the Sunday after the awards in Kalmar, I went to Ironman Copenhagen, did a couple of hours in the finish line there with Gordon Graham, and did the awards on the Monday.
Yeah, that's not such a bad one, is it, really? Because you're only nipping down the road and over the bridge into Denmark. It's an easy one to get to.
Yeah, but with no voice.
Yeah. So anyway, look, let's wrap up. You mentioned Kona. You mentioned that when you're talking about your favourite races, you don't even talk about Kona because it's sort of up there. So was it 2014 or 2015 when you got your first go in Kona on the finish line?
2014 was my first go in Kona. That was on the hot corner. 2015 was hot corner and bike check-in, and I became a part of the Banquet of Champions. And 2016 was my first time on the finish line, just assisting Mike Riley when he just needed to take a break or when things went crazy.
Yeah, but you've been part of that commentary team ever since, and now you're an integral part of the finish line team, aren't you? Really? Or so it seems.
I'd like to believe so. You know, I think Mike and I work really, really well together. You know, Mike he's the boss, he's the leader, follow his lead, and just help him do his job as well as possible, and just learn and listen and add value. You know, I don't need to be top of the pops. I don't need to be the king. I've always wanted to just be a part of the Kona team. When I gave up my corporate job and tried to see if I could turn my hobby of announcing into something that would pay the mortgage and maintenance and put food on the table and fuel in the car, I had to set myself two goals. And the one goal was within 5 years to be announcing in Hawaii. And that would have been 2015. And I got there in 2014. I was very happy with that. My other goal is I'd love to be some part of triathlon announcing or commentary at the Olympics. And having lived in Tokyo, it would be nothing more spectacular for me than if I could crack the nod to be somehow part of the triathlon and the Olympics in 2020. My fingers are crossed, and, you know, God be willing.
I've got one thing left to ask you, Paul, but you may not want to answer this or even discuss it. It may be a sort of an embargo on it. At the finish line last year in Kona, you were waiting. We were all waiting. I was there I'd been volunteering to catch people. We were waiting at the finish line for that final lady to come over. She was bent double. She was grabbing hold of the hoardings in front of the spectators. She could hardly move. And in a moment, without even thinking, Mike Riley rushed out from the finish line and started to help her across the line. He still had got his microphone in his hand. You could hear him encourage her, come on, come on, trying to get her there. The crowd were willing her there. Every bit of human emotion thought that Mike Riley did the right thing. But of course, was that considered outside assistance?
Well, the rules say that outside assistance is if you're assisted by somebody who's not an Ironman official. Hmm. Mike Riley is an Ironman official. So okay. As far as the rules are concerned, that's no issue for me. I've helped athletes at races because I'm an Ironman official. And I've prevented them receiving assistance from non-officials. Mike Riley is a human being, and he's got a very big heart. Yeah. And he was not thinking. He went and did what he believed was right. Some people think that's wrong. He stands by. He did what he believes right. I'm not going to have an opinion on that. I watched it. I saw it happen. I saw some of the reactions to it. You know, in the heat of the moment, just think of how much better this world would be if in the heat of any moment we helped somebody instead of standing by the sidelines.
Well, that final comment is probably a great place to finish, Paul Kay. Let's repeat that. You repeat it, Paul. Say that again, that one last thing, because I love that.
The world would be a better place if in the heat of the moment somebody needed assistance, instead of standing by the side and watching it happen, we actually went and helped. That wasn't word for word what I said first time, but it's what I believe. You know, often we think that we can't change this world because we think the problems are too big. But even the smallest random act of kindness, you know, there's a ripple effect. And one by one, we make this world a better place. And that's why I love what I do, because one by one, I see people change their lives and I get to be a part of that.
Fantastic. Well, listeners, if you've not yet had the pleasure of being greeted at the start line and at the finish line by my guest today, Mr. Paul Kay, I do hope that you get to experience that at an Ironman 70.3 or a full Ironman distance at some stage in the future. Paul knows how to make the finish line emotional. He's been there to greet me across the finish line. I've stood there and shaken hands with him while he's doing his job and watched him greet other people come across the finish line. And certainly, if you're racing in Europe, there's a good chance that you will get to experience this. So please make a time to go and say hello to Paul. He's always got time to say hello to triathletes. So, Paul, thanks so much for being on the show today. It's been fantastic. A real insight into your life and your work and your passion and enthusiasm. Any final words for our listeners before you go, other than goodbye?
All I want to say is that if you have a 5150 or a 70.3 on Ironman on your horizon, happy training. For those of you sitting on the fence, get off the fence. You will be an Ironman.
So there you have it. That was my guest today, Mr. Paul Kay. I'm your host, Simon Ward. This was the Triathlon Coach Swapcast. We'll be back next week with another equally fantastic guest from myself and from Paul. Have a great week. That's a wrap for this week's episode. Thank you so much for listening to the conversation, and I hope you learned at least one thing. If this is the first time you've listened in, please go back and take a listen to some of our previous guests, and I can guarantee they will be just as good as the one you've just heard. If you've been a regular listener, then thank you for being a part of this journey with me so far. Finally, I'd like to take just a few seconds to tell you about my SWAT Inner Circle program. In the last few years, I spent an awful lot of time creating training programs and resources to help you train and race at whatever triathlon distance you choose, and for some of the events outside of triathlon like aquabike, duathlon and swim run events. As a SWAT member, you get access to all of these plans for 12 months of the year, and on top of that we provide guidance on strength and conditioning, nutrition, plus a whole host of other supportive activities which help you to train, recover and race better. We also have a really friendly Facebook community. It's an exclusive Facebook page for SWAT members only, and there are over 150 of them already. If you join, you'll be able to get access to that page, and you'll be able to ask for help, and our members are all too happy to provide guidance and advice based on their experiences. I'll also be there to help you find solutions to your training problems, and all you have to do is tag me in the Facebook page in one of your posts, or you can book a 15-minute phone call should you need one. If you'd like more information, or if you're ready to press the button and join the SWAT Inner Circle, just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com and she will send you all of the details. So that's all for this week. Hopefully I'll see you again next week, same time, same place, with a different guest.